Hello and welcome to our viewers here and around the world. I'm Christiane Amanpour, and at the top of the news this week, President Obama on the ropes.
I'm exhausted of defending you.
He faces tough criticism from his own supporters as Republicans unveil their pledge to roll back his agenda.
The government is out of control in Washington.
Can Democrats mobilize for this political war? Will voters buy the Republican plan? Two This Week exclusive interviews, the president's chief political advisor, David Axelrod, and the top Republican in the Senate, Mitch McConnell, only on This Week. And Queen Rania of Jordan in a Sunday exclusive. As the U.S. scrambles to save the Middle East peace talks, we get her view.
Extremists have done a damn good job of using this cause to amplify their message.
Her efforts in the fight against extremism and for the rights of women and children. Then, Obama's real war, Afghanistan, and Bob Woodward's new inside look at the battles over policy in the White House. We'll discuss that and all the week's politics in our roundtable with George Will, Donna Brazile, Matthew Dowd, and Ron Brownstein. And the Sunday funnies.
Listen to this. One day, Delaware elects a witch. The next day, the recession is over. I don't know. Is that a coincidence?
From all across our world to the heart of our nation's capital, ABC This Week with Christiane Amanpour starts now.
Hello again, and this week the recession was finally declared over. It officially ended June 2009, but the recovery has been slow and the voters have been losing patience. With 5 weeks to go before the midterm elections, President Obama and congressional Democrats are facing potentially huge political losses. Joining me now, the president's top political advisor, David Axelrod. Thank you for joining us.
Great to be here.
I want to first, though, ask you about something very close to what the president has been doing, and that's Middle East peace. Mm-hmm. The moratorium expires tonight.
Yes.
The president asked the Israeli prime minister to keep the moratorium on. He's not going to do it. What is going to stop these talks from collapsing?
Well, look, I don't want to prejudge what's going to happen in the next,
many
hours. There are still, the parties are still working. They're still talking. Secretary Clinton and her team are working with them. We're very eager to keep these talks going. We think this is an unparalleled opportunity and a rare one. And we have to seize the advantage of that. And we are going to urge and push throughout this day to get some kind of resolution.
So you think you'll manage to urge to keep the moratorium on, or is that going to expire?
Well, I'm not going to get into the details of what's being discussed, but what is most important now is that the parties are at the table, they're having serious discussions, they ought to keep on having those discussions, and we are very eager to see that happen.
Do you see any creative compromise to make that happen? The Palestinians say they would walk.
Well, I understand what the public pronouncements have been, but the parties are at the table. They're talking, they're trying to work this through, and we're hopeful that they will.
Mm-hmm. You know, King Abdullah, one of the president's main partners in this process, has said on Jon Stewart that there could be war if this moratorium expires. How do you take that?
Well, look, obviously, this is there are a lot of stakes here. I saw that quote. I'm not going to comment on that quote, but everyone understands that these talks themselves are absolutely crucial. We're at a pivotal juncture in that region. It's important for Israel. It's important for the Palestinians. We think it's essential that they keep on moving forward, keep on talking, keep on trying to work through these issues. We're hopeful that they will.
Let me turn now to the political situation, mm-hmm. and particularly in light this week of something else everybody's talking about, and that is the CNBC town hall meeting that the president mm-hmm. had right here in the museum, at which one of his staunch defenders stood up and said that she was getting tired. Let me play this for you.
Quite frankly, I'm exhausted. I'm exhausted of defending you, defending your administration, right. defending the mantle of change that I voted for, right. and deeply disappointed with where we are right now. I've been told that I voted for a man who said he was going to change things in a meaningful way for the middle class. I'm one of those people, and I'm waiting, sir. I'm waiting.
A lot of people are waiting, Mr. Axelrod. How is the president, how are you going to jazz your electorate, your base, ahead of these elections?
Well, first of all, let's understand that we've gone through a terrible time in this country. I understand what she was saying. The middle class has taken a terrible beating, not just in the last 2 years of this recession, but over the last 10 years. We learned in the last few days that the middle class lost 5% of their income from 2001 to 2009. And of course, that period ended with the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. The key here is to keep moving forward, to keep doing things that have at its core, that has at its core the economic security of the middle class, which is key to our economic growth, not to go back to the policies that created the crisis in the first place.
All right, but really a lot of people, I mean, people from all over the world, frankly, say to me, here comes a president with a huge mandate, a huge reservoir of goodwill, huge promises to change. And with all of that, his popularity is down. People don't appreciate some of the amazing legislative agenda that he's accomplished. Is this a failure of leadership? Has he allowed the opposition to define him?
I don't think, Christiane, that you can say he's accomplished all these amazing things, and it's a failure of leadership. It was leadership
results
that produced that. We have endured the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. It took a decade to build up to that. It'll take more time than anybody would like to deal with the remnants of it. There's devastation as a result of that. And we're working every day. And we're obviously in a different place from January of 2009 when we were losing 800,000 jobs a month. Now we've had job growth all this year, private sector job growth. But we have to accelerate that. And the president's made a series of proposals to do that. Hopefully, we can get some cooperation on the other side to make that happen.
Well, the other side, as you know, has brought out their pledge for America. The yes. Republicans are feeling very confident right now. And people are looking at, you know, what happened in 1994 when President Clinton lost Congress to the Republicans then. And he actually had some advice for President Obama, which he told George Stephanopoulos. I'd like to play that right now and get your reaction.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to see him say, we couldn't get out of this $3 trillion hole in 21 months. Give us two more years. Don't go back to the policies that dug the hole. But if we don't do better, this is the last thing. If we don't do better, you can vote against us all, and I'll be on the ballot too. Vote against us all if it's not better.
So is that good political advice, vote against us all? Is that what President Obama will take, that advice? Will he say that to people?
President Clinton is a great politician, and I'm not in any way going to quarrel with him. I think people in 2012 will vote on this. I don't think they need an invitation to do so. I think the crux of what he's saying is absolutely right, though. When you look at that pledge to America, it is a complete echo of what was done before. It would borrow $700 billion to cut taxes for the very wealthy, add trillions of dollars to the deficits. It would unleash the special interests to be writing rules here on Capitol Hill again. And it would cut things like there's a 20% cut in there for education. We're talking about our economy. Education is the defense budget of the economic defense budget of the 21st century. And they're basically talking about disarmament. 8 million kids would have their college age aid slashed under this budget. This isn't a prescription for economic growth. This is a prescription for surrender. We can't do that.
What about one of the things that the president has been talking about for so long, and that is the tax breaks? Why did the Democrats decide to push that aside before the midterms?
Well, look, here's where we are, and you can talk to your next guest about it. What the Republicans have said, and they said it again in this pledge, is what we've said is we want to extend tax cuts for people up to $250,000 of income. That would cover 98% of the American people. They say, no, we won't do that alone. We want to borrow another $700 billion over the next 10 years to give tax cuts to millionaires and billionaires. And we're saying we can't afford that, not in our fiscal condition. And and now they want to hold those middle class tax cuts hostage unless and until we agree to that. And that's something we can't do.
But if you can't do it now and you're not going to do it now, how are you going to do it after these elections
when
you might have less of a
majority? I believe when these Republican members return to their districts, they're going to have to explain to their constituents why they're holding up tax cuts for the middle class. And I think it's an untenable position to say, we're going to allow your taxes to go up on January 1st unless the president agrees to give tax cuts to millionaires and billionaires.
But
this is exactly how we got into the jam we were in before. This is how they quadrupled the national debt and exploded the deficits and squandered the surplus that Bill Clinton left them.
People are very upset about the national debt and the deficits and all the rest of it right now. But also, the president talked about extending the middle class tax cuts. Can you do that after the election?
Well, we're going to get that done one way or the other. We're going to get it done. And I believe the pressure is going to build among the American people. I don't believe Senator McConnell or anybody else is going to be willing to stand up to the American people and say, we're going to hold your tax cut hostage so that we can give another large tax cut to millionaires and billionaires that we can't afford.
Quick answers to some of the statements that have come out in Bob Woodward's book, particularly some about yourself. General Petraeus, the commander now in Afghanistan, said a couple of things, according to the book. One, this White House, they don't know who they're XXX with, messing with. And another, that he didn't like talking to you because you are, quote, a complete spin doctor.
Well, look, I've seen General Petraeus in interviews with you and others, and I've always been impressed by how deft he is on TV, so I assume he meant that as a compliment.
Oh, you think so?
Yes.
Tell me how you think you're going to, and do you believe there'll be a confrontation between what the White House believes, which is to have this drawdown in 2011, and what General Petraeus seems very, very clearly to be laying the groundwork for, and that is much, much less of a drawdown, if at all, by 2011?
I think General Petraeus and everyone involved was there through this process and at the end of the process, and everyone agreed that the drawdown would begin in July of 2011, and not a trivial drawdown, but a real drawdown.
And one last question. Everybody's also talking about, you know, reshuffles in the White House. Rahm Emanuel, who apparently wants to run for mayor of Chicago, will he leave before the midterms?
Well, look, filing for that is November 22nd, I believe, in Chicago. And obviously it takes some time if you're going to run for mayor to do it. So it stands to reason that he would have to leave earlier if he decides to do it. And that's something he's still working through.
What's your, if you had to bet, will he do it and will he leave before the midterms?
I never bet on national television.
What do you think will happen?
I think that he loves the city of Chicago. He's always believed that that was the greatest job there is. So I think he's drawn to it, but he still has family considerations to think about, and he's working those through.
David Axelrod, thank you very much indeed. And joining me now is the Republican leader in the Senate, Senator Mitch McConnell. Welcome to This Week.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining
Glad
us.
Glad to be here.
You heard what David Axelrod said about the Republican plan on extending all the Bush-era tax cuts, and that it would really, you know, put the country more in hock. Analysts say that it'll cause, you know, add some $4 trillion or so to the national debt. Are you really going to do that, or do you think there will be a compromise on extending the middle-class tax cuts?
Well, let's understand what we're talking about here. This has been the tax rate for a decade. We're talking about raising taxes in the middle of a recession. And most economists think that's the worst thing you could do. The president himself was saying that was the worst thing you could do a year and a half ago. So raising taxes in the middle of a recession is a particularly bad idea, and Republicans don't think that's what we ought to do.
So do you not think, I mean, will you, quote, unquote, hold the middle class tax cut hostage to all the tax cuts you want to
extend?
Well,
nothing's being held hostage to anything. It was the Democrats themselves who decided not to have this
debate.
Would
you compromise on that, even after the
election? I was the only one who offered a bill. There was never a bill in the Senate. And you know why? 31 Democrats in the House, 5 Democrats in the Senate, said they agreed with me that we ought not to raise taxes in the middle of a recession. What might happen down the road is not the subject today. The question is, do we want to raise taxes in the middle of a very, very tough economy? All the Republicans think that's a bad idea, and a substantial number of the Democrats think the same thing.
Right, but there's also this huge thing that the people of the United States are worried about, and that is the deficit.
Absolutely.
And adding, keeping the tax cuts will add trillions to that. And let me ask you this. According to Howard Gleckman at the Tax Policy Center, let's see what he's just written, McConnell would have to abolish all the rest of the government to get a balance by 2020. Everything. No more national parks, no more NIH, no more highway construction, no more Homeland Security, and no more Congress.
Let me tell you
how you reduce
the deficit. The two things you need to do. Number one, you need to get spending down. And number two, you need to get the economy going.
Right.
Everything that's happened in the last year and a half has been to pump up the government. We borrowed stimulus money. We spent it to hire new federal government workers. We sent it down to state so they would not have to lay off state workers. You have to get the economy going. That's the way you narrow the deficit. You get the economy going. You get government spending down. Throw a tax increase in there. We're going to have this recession go on who knows how long.
But you're still not saying where the big, big cuts would come from, because some of the things you're talking about...
Let me give you an example of something
we're doing
already.
Social Security or Medicare, Medicaid, wouldn't be the defense.
Let me give you an example of something we're doing already. Senate Republicans offered to freeze the top line on next year's appropriations at essentially what we spent this year. The difference between that and what the president asked for over a 10-year period would be $300 billion. With regard to the entitlements, the president has appointed a deficit reduction commission. I've appointed three members to it. John Boehner's appointed three members to it. They're going to report in December and make a recommendation about what we might do about our long-term unfunded liabilities. We'll wait and see what they recommend, but hopefully it'll be something that will be supported on a bipartisan basis.
So all of this comes into the Pledge for America, which was announced this week, a platform for future governing by the Republicans. Now, many people say that it's simply more of the same. You've obviously heard a lot of that over the last couple of days. There's basically nothing new. And whether they're left, right, or center, people are complaining that, in fact, it doesn't go far enough, particularly for the very enthusiastic Tea Party base that you have. So, for instance, Eric Erickson has written about this pledge. It's full of mom-tested, kid-approved pablum that will make certain hearts on the right sing in solidarity, but like a diet full of sugar, it would actually do nothing but keep making Washington fatter before we crash from the sugar high. How are you going to... Were you laughing?
Well, anytime you do anything in public life, somebody criticizes it. Go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to...
No, that's all right. But I want to ask you, how will you satisfy the base, which seems to be really an insurrection now, the Tea Party? Would you agree that they're
cascading into your space? Let me tell you what everybody agrees on. Everybody agrees on. The primaries are over, and we all agree we want to go out and beat the Democrats November 2nd.
Right.
So there's all kinds of energy in the Republican Party, or people who are inclined to vote Republican. The Tea Party people are not all Republicans, some independents. But one thing we know about everybody who's been active in this movement, we know none of them are going to go out and vote Democrat on November 2nd. We may have some internal differences about various parts, but everybody knows who's been in charge of the government for the last year and a half.
Well,
everybody knows who's been in charge of the government for the last year and a half. The Democrats have had the White House. They've had a huge margin in the House, a big margin in the Senate, and they know that if they want to save America, they've got to change the Congress, and that's going to happen on November 2nd.
Well, as you know, the recession was declared over. There's no recession, and many will say that they stopped it from going into a Great Depression and that they inherited this awful situation. But let me ask you this.
Yeah.
You say you want to go out and win in November. Yeah. I want to play for you something that Tom Ross, the chairman of the Republican Party in Delaware, said to me on this program right after Christine O'Donnell, the Tea Party candidate, won in that last primary in Delaware. Let's just play what he said.
We had a candidate that was very close to becoming the next United States Senator from Delaware, and essentially people on our own team clipped him right as he is about to go on the goal line.
Right. So that's Mike Castle, who they thought would win that election come November. And now he's basically saying, perhaps not. So how do you square that? I mean, do you think these Tea Party candidates will be good for you in November?
Look, there are 12 places now, right now, where there's a Democratic senator where our candidate is either a little bit behind, dead even, or well ahead. California, Washington, Nevada, Colorado, Illinois, Pennsylvania, Indiana, North Dakota, Arkansas, Wisconsin, Connecticut, West Virginia. We're competitive in a lot of places. Will we win them all? Who knows? The Delaware primary was interesting. A new candidate, fresh face. I think she's got a good chance of winning.
But, I mean, she definitely wasn't your candidate. I mean, basically, one would say that Republican...
You picked out one Senate race.
No,
I just gave you 12 places we have a chance of beating
Democrats. Even in your own state. And I want to ask you, actually, what are the qualifications do these people have? For instance, what is Christine O'Donnell's qualification for actually governing? Mm-hmm. What is Sharon Angle's actual qualification for governing?
Well, they won the primary fair and square against real competition, and they emerged as the nominee. And Sharon Angle is running no worse than dead even against the majority leader of the Senate. I think that's pretty significant.
Are you not afraid that there might be a turnoff?
Am I afraid of having more Republicans in the Senate?
No,
that wasn't
the question. The question is, are you not afraid that they're somewhat, one would say, some might say, bizarre statements, their sort of fringe quality, might actually turn people off. I mean, for instance, what do you say about a Sharon Angle, who I know you just had a fundraiser for, who basically talks about enemies in Congress and talks and hints about, you know, armed rebellion to put them down? I mean, is that the kind of talk from a United States senator?
You know what most Americans think is extreme?
No, I'm asking you that question.
Well, I know what I'm going to answer.
Because these might be senators.
I'm going to answer it. What most Americans think is extreme is the kind of government we've been running for the last year and a half. We've seen the government taking over banks, insurance companies, car companies, nationalizing the student loan business. We're on a path to double the national debt in 5 years and triple it in 10. Most Americans think what's been happening around here for the last year and a half is extreme, and they want to change it. And they know that the way to change it is to change the Congress, because you don't get to make policy unless you get elected.
But you didn't tell me what you think about those kinds of comments from people who want to be, you know, a senator. I mean, it's kind of bizarre, don't you agree?
I don't think the people of Nevada should be attacked for the choice they made in the primary. And the candidate is running dead even with the majority leader of the United States Senate. Obviously, the people of Nevada think that she's a very good candidate, or she wouldn't be running even with someone of such power and significance.
Do you think there'll be more bipartisan compromise when they come in, or less?
I think the way to get bipartisan compromise is to not have one side have an overwhelming majority. And the American people know that if they're frustrated with this administration, it won't change on November 2nd. The president will still be there for at least two more years. But they can take the first step toward moving this government back toward the political center, and maybe even a little bit right of center if there's a very good election.
Senator Mitch McConnell, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.
And Middle East peace talks are at a critical stage this weekend. Israel's moratorium on settlements expires in a few hours. So will the talks collapse? And all this was on the mind of Queen Rania of Jordan when we sat down to talk this week. She was in New York for the UN General Assembly. Jordan, along with Egypt, are the only two Arab countries which have made peace with Israel. And this queen, a mother of four, is on a campaign to promote moderate voices in the Arab world and to counter the extremists. Your Majesty, thank you for joining us.
Pleasure. Thank you, Christian.
There is, as you know, a peace process in place right now. Everybody's waiting to see whether the Prime Minister of Israel keeps the moratorium on and whether the Palestinian president stays at the talks. Do you think he should stay at the talks?
Absolutely.
Moratorium or not?
Well, that's something to be discussed. I know that there's a lot of cynicism, and I know that a lot of people don't believe that it's going to happen. And it's not easy. If it was easy, it would have happened by now. But what's very important to emphasize is why this peace process is important, why we mustn't let cynicism or pessimism just dismiss the whole process. And if you look at the religious situation and what we're seeing here, the tensions that exist, I'm not saying that the Middle East problem, Israelis and Palestinian issue, is the one that created religious extremism. Religious extremism would have existed anyway, but extremists have done a damn good job of using this cause to amplify their message, you know, to try to reach the masses. And we need to realize that when there is a population that is living under occupation, that where there's no justice, where they can't send their children to school, where mothers have to deliver on checkpoints, and on the other side, where Israelis feel that they have to build a bubble, you know, they have to build a wall in order to exist safely because they live in such a hostile environment, that is an explosive situation that has repercussions not only on our region, but on our entire world. And we see those, even the debates that are going on in the States. So we have an extremely high stake and vested interest in seeing these negotiations move forward. In terms of the settlements that you were asking me about, you know, whether there's the moratorium continues or not, what matters to me is what actually happens on the ground. You know, if both sides are still talking and in the spirit of peace, these settlements are not expanded upon, then I think both sides need to be flexible. As long as they continue to talk, we need to see results. The Palestinian people and the Israeli people need to see change, tangible change in their lives very soon.
President Obama figures very strongly in this Middle East peace process, of course. He's brought the two sides together. Unfortunately, Pew polls and others now show his popularity dipping in the Islamic world, including in Jordan. What are your thoughts on that?
Simple. Let's see what happens with the Middle East. If we achieve success with this round of Middle East talks, then let's check his popularity ratings after that. I think they'll skyrocket.
You mentioned how this extremist ideology is even coming to play in the United States. You've seen the reaction and the fallout from the Islamic Center, but it goes broader than that. Do you see a sort of a dangerous Islamophobia in the United States? How do you assess what's happening here?
Well, you know, it just really surprised me how inflamed this issue became. What really should be driving this debate is what is the road to reconciliation? At the end of the day, this is a center that is about religious harmony. It's about tolerance. If people understand that this is a center that does not play in the hand of the bin Ladens of this world, but rather confronts them and undermines them.
But do you worry that people here sometimes confuse bin Laden
Absolutely.
With Islam in general?
Absolutely. I think the major failure that's going on is an inability or refusal to make a distinction between the extremists, like the bin Ladens of this world, and the rest of the Muslims. You know, so for me, bin Laden doesn't represent me. He doesn't represent millions of people, millions of Muslims around the world. And I think that that's one of the worst and cruelest legacies of 9/11, is the fact that it's changed our hearts. It's made people more fearful of people of other religions or people who look different or dress different. And it's so contradictory to the most beautiful values of the United States. You know, people look at the United States as a leader in terms of religious tolerance and freedom of worship. Now, the people of America need to decide, do they want to continue to play this leadership role to the rest of the world? Because even the Arab world, even the Muslim world, we look up to the United States when it comes to freedoms.
Then how does the Muslim world reclaim that moderate center to allay the fears here?
I think the Muslim world has to speak out more. Moderates in general have to speak out more. And also, when they speak, there needs to be people listening on the other side, because this is a debate that affects how the future generations think and feel.
It's the UN General Assembly, mm-hmm. and you're here in part because of the Millennium Development Goals. Now, for a lot of people, that's jargon, mm-hmm. but what do the MDGs actually aim for?
Well, in the year 2000, world leaders came together and they made 8 promises. You know, dealing with maternal health, child mortality, education, gender equality, climate change, cutting down poverty. There has been some progress made, but it's been uneven. I think the food crisis, the economic crisis, the climate crisis, all those have meant that in many cases we've limped rather than leaped. So we have to redouble our efforts to make sure that we reach these goals.
In the 10 years since 2000, what has been achieved on eradicating extreme poverty? That was one promise.
Yes.
Making universal primary education accessible, empowering women.
Right. Education and empowerment of women are two that I'm concerned about, because if we reach those two, they underpin success for all the other goals.
Many of the reports about the Arab world say that one of the reasons it lags behind the rest of the developing world is because it disempowers half its population, i.e.
Absolutely.
The women.
Absolutely. I totally agree with that. I think, you know, when you look at the Middle East and North Africa region, we're one of the biggest spenders on education. And in most countries, there is gender parity in terms of education. So even across 12 of the Arab states, you have just as many girls as boys going to school, and in many cases, many more women graduating from university than men. But the problem is that although we're making these investments in women, we're not reaping the benefits because they're not going into the workplace.
Do you get pushback from some of the more Islamic party members, for instance, the Islamic groups in Jordan?
Not necessarily Islamic, because Islam does not say that women shouldn't work.
No, it doesn't, you know? But some of the political types.
But there are certain conservative mindsets that think that it's either or. Either you work or you have a family, you can't do both. We're still at a very low level in terms of women's female participation. But women are proving themselves in the business sector. We have women in the army. We have women in the security forces. We have female judges, entrepreneurs, all over. But it's going to be incremental, and sometimes it's generational. You can't have, you know, the Western way of doing things can't be our way of doing things.
Your Majesty, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Christian.
Your fresh new ideas sound slightly like, I'm sorry, did I say slightly? Exactly like your old ideas.
Rein in the Washington, D.C. red tape.
Cut Washington red tape.
Act immediately to reduce spending.
Have real reforms to reduce spending.
Change the way we do business in Washington.
Change business as usual in Washington.
Make the tax cuts permanent.
Make the existing tax cuts permit.
A smaller,
less costly,
and more accountable
government
in our nation's capital.
John Stewart from The Daily Show with his own take on the House Republican Pledge to America. One of the topics we'll discuss today on our roundtable with George Will, Democratic strategist Donna Brazil, Ron Brownstein of the National Journal, and Matthew Dowd, former Bush political strategist. Welcome to you all. So, George, Pledge to America, it's nice, it's glossy, there are lots of pictures. Is it new?
No, in the sense that Mr. Stewart's quite right, that Republicans are acting like Republicans, which is sort of what they want to do. Limited government, smaller government, less spending. This was prepared against the backdrop of what I consider the most important number in all the blizzard of numbers we're hearing this year. Only one in four Americans expects their economic condition to be better next year than this year, so they're gloomy. They blame it on that institution, six blocks away, and the one 10 blocks away that way.
Congress and the White House,
and that's why in that pledge, the word spending appears 47 times. A perfunctory nod to the social issues, but this is about economics.
Mm-hmm. Spending. I tried to get it out of Senator McConnell. You know, they talk about rolling back spending, but where? Are they going to take on the big issues of Social Security and all the rest?
Well, the interesting thing about this, first of all, the only people that are going to have read this thing are the person that wrote it and maybe the person that printed it. It's not going to have any effect on the election. But the problem that the country has is that they don't trust either party on spending. They went through years during the Bush presidency where spending rose dramatically. Now now 2 years into the Obama presidency where spending has risen dramatically. So the country doesn't really trust any of them. So that's why they're trying to kick out. And the next round, if they kicked them out in 2006, they're going to kick out a whole bunch in this year, 2010. That's the problem, that the country does not trust either political party to do what they want to do. So that's why they're sending what many people consider fringe candidates to Washington.
And, you know, it's not only the political parties they don't trust. And that's where I would amend or disagree a little bit with George. What happened after 2008, after the financial meltdown, was that trust cratered in both government and business. Obama overestimated the extent to which the public would be looking to government to counteract business, have a larger role in the economy, and they are seeing the backlash of that now. There's clearly a portion of what's happening now is an ideological backlash among voters who simply don't trust Washington to do the kinds of things that the Democrats have set it on a road to do. On the other hand, there is a tremendous loss of faith in business as well, and I think Republicans do face the risk, depending on how they interpret what happens in November, of coming in and, as in 95, trying to go too far in the other direction and seeing a backlash against their efforts to retrench government. We've done polling in the last few weeks. Only one-third of Americans say they support extending the Bush tax cuts to everybody, including those over 250. Only one-third support the idea of repealing health care completely, and only one-third support the idea of converting Medicare into a voucher for seniors, as some of the House Republicans want to do.
You know, Christiane, I read it. It's retro. It's recycled old material from the past. It's vague. It's a fig leaf to cover the thinness of their proposals. There is some spending in that booklet. It's spending more on the military. It's spending money that we don't have. It's spending more on tax cuts that we can't afford. So this is an opportunity for Republicans to finally say we're for something, but it gives Democrats to say what they've been against over the last 18 months.
But given what Ron just said about the numbers and what people think about health care and the rest, why then haven't the Democrats been able to translate that into a positive message?
Because I think it's been very difficult to have a narrative that tells the American people exactly what they don't want to hear, that we've spent your money, your taxpayers' money, to try to avoid a total meltdown on the economy, to invest in things that the Republicans didn't care about, and to try to put the economy back on a sane footing. That has not translated into votes, and it hasn't given Democrats a real opportunity to campaign.
I think the real problem is that nothing has happened since Barack Obama has taken office that's positive in the American public's mind. Their health care costs have risen. Their premiums have risen on their health care. The job situation has worsened. The deficit has worsened. Everything since January 20th, 2009, has gotten worse.
But when you say nothing's happened, that he's pushed a huge amount through Congress, unprecedented amount. Are you saying nothing's happened?
The public does not judge success based on passing a bill in Washington. The public judges success based on whether or not their life is better, and it has not changed.
Right, but there's no depression. The recession has ended.
Yeah, well, but they're not seeing, people are not seeing tangible gains in their life, as Matthew said. I mean, look, I think you have two things. The public view is actually pretty nuanced. If you look at polling and when you go out and you talk to people, by and large, more Americans think that the policies of Bush than Obama certainly led to this cataclysm. On the other hand, they have judged that what Obama has done over the past year and a half has not made things better. And that is the driving force of the election. Now, what Democrats are trying to do in these last few weeks by focusing on Republican policies is basically saying, look, the issue shouldn't be about what's happened over the last 20 months. It shouldn't be a referendum. It should be a choice about alternative directions going forward. That is a very hard place to get the voters in a midterm election.
You think it will be a referendum?
Well, yeah. Look at the difficulties they have. They passed a stimulus which, by their own standards, did not stimulate, didn't keep unemployment at 8%. They passed a health care bill that may not be, as Michael Barone says, the most unpopular major legislation since the Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854, but it's unpopular. So then they said, well, we'll run against George W. Bush. Well, in Ohio, Mr. Portman is about to be elected senator, who was a close aide of George Bush. They said, well, let's run against Wall Street. Well, in Ohio, Mr. Kasich is leading in the race for governor. He worked for Lehman Brothers. None of these standard lines of theirs have worked.
And we just were talking about, you just mentioned the word fringe. I asked Senator McConnell about some of these, you know, Tea Party candidates who may be going to the Senate. And you've just written this article, Extreme Makeover, whose subtitle is, the midterm elections could send to Washington the most militantly conservative class of new senators in at least the past half century. What will that mean?
Well, it's going to be a stronger infusion of conservative energy and more uniformly conservative energy than we saw even in the class of 94 or 1980. There are a range of views among this class. We looked at the 21 Republican Senate challengers with the best chance of winning. There are a range of views in terms of the long-range agenda. Someone like Christine O'Donnell or Sharon Angle or Joe Miller in Alaska would go further than Rob Portman or Roy Blunt or some of the other John Hoeven in North Dakota, the more conventional candidates. But when you look at what is actually going to be on the table in the next couple of years, there is more unanimity and a more consistently conservative line among this Republican class than we have seen really at any point. Just a couple quick examples. All 21 of them say they will extend the Bush tax cuts. 20 of 21 of them say they will oppose any future tax hikes. 20 of 20, all who have taken a position, support a balanced budget amendment, they all oppose cap and trade. 19 of the 20 who have taken a position say that global climate change is unproven or actually a hoax. So in the long term, there may be differences about some candidates wanting to go further about rolling back the minimum wage, unemployment benefits associated, but on what they will actually be dealing with, you will see, I think, a very strong pull toward a more conservative, a consistently conservative position in that Republican caucus.
Doesn't that just add to the deficit, all these tax cuts?
Well, making all of those things add up is going to be the challenge, both right, in the near term and the long term, absolutely.
But you know, the Republicans have a great story right now to tell. Excuse my voice. I was up watching the LSU game, clearly. But the problem I have, and the Republicans should understand, is that there's still an internal civil war going on within the Republican Party in Washington State, in Delaware, in Colorado. Many of the mainstream Republican candidates have not endorsed the Tea Party candidates, that they provided enthusiasm, they provided a lot of energy and organization for the Republican Party. But we don't know yet if the Republicans can heal those wounds and provide the kind of turnout they need to beat the Democrats.
If you gave most Democrats truth serum and they said whose place would they rather be in, mm-hmm, they would pick the Republicans' place in this year's election as opposed to their own place in this year's election. The problem, I think, for this class that's coming in for the Republicans is for Mitch McConnell, who you just talked to, is his ability to herd them is going to be like, mm-hmm, herding quail. Because these folks are coming to Washington and think, I'm not going to be part of this. I'm not going to listen to the leaders. Right. I'm going to do what the voters want me to do. And they're not going to be acquiescent to what the leaders
do. And that's what I wanted to ask, because in today's newspaper, there's a quote by a senior Republican consultant that after the elections, it's going to be basically all-out war, a struggle, mm-hmm, for the heart and the soul of the Republican Party. You're shaking your head.
They've been writing this story for 8 months about what a problem the Tea Party is for the Republican Party. You know what the problem
is? Well, Tom Ross basically told us that they lost because of that, and they might lose.
On balance across the country, the Tea Party is enormous help for the Republicans. At the beginning of the year, the question was, will the Tea Party people play nicely with others, and will they obey the rules of politics? Who's sort of not playing nicely? Mr. Crist starts losing the primary to a Tea Party favorite, Rubio. He suddenly discovers that he's an independent and changes all his views overnight. Mrs. Murkowski loses a primary and suddenly discovers that she has a property right in her Senate seat, and she's going to run as a write-in. Senator Bennett thought of that in Utah. Senator Castle in Delaware is thinking of a write-in candidate. Who are the extremists?
Hey, look, you think about Arlen Specter.
Donna, I would say, look, I mean, I think clearly this class of Republicans do not feel they are being sent here to Washington to compromise with Barack Obama or to follow the Republican leadership. So in that sense, there is going to be tension, and I quote Ken Buck in my story as saying so. But if you look at what they are actually going to be voting on in all likelihood over the next 2 years, there is remarkable unanimity in this class. And despite all the focus on the Civil War, I think that is kind of the long-range vision of what the federal government should be doing or not doing is where you will see divergence.
But
in the near term, I think in terms of the main thing that the Republicans, I think, are being sent here to do is to block and try to roll back whatever they can of Obama did. I think the spending thing will continue to be a challenge for them, because if you want to reduce the deficits and extend the Bush tax cuts, that does point you back toward cutting Medicare and Medicaid, which is exactly the problem they got into in 95. And they may end up in that same cul-de-sac next year. But I actually believe there is more commonality in this class than is often assumed. And on the near term, they are going to be a very formidable and, I think, cohesive force.
And look at the not-so-near term. In the next two cycles, 2012 and 2014 combined, the Democrats are defending 43 Senate seats, Republicans 22. So the Republican wave that's now starting is just starting.
Let's turn to a real war, and that is Afghanistan and Bob Woodward's Inside Fly on the Wall. Look at it. Can I just ask you, yes, he is a brilliant writer and he sells books. Why would the White House over and over again give him the keys?
Well, no. I think part of it, I mean, this happened in the Bush White House.
Yeah.
There's this appeal about him based on 30-something years ago and what happened with Watergate, and he has an aura about him that people think they have to talk to him if they want to be part of the history. That Bob Woodward, if you got to talk to Bob Woodward, if you wanted to tell your narrative in history. So they go to his house and they sit around and have sandwiches and iced tea or lemonade, and they talk because they want to be part of history.
And it turned out quite well, would you say, for the administration?
Well, it showed that the president was decisive, that he was involved deeply in the strategy in Afghanistan, that he participated in all of the internal discussions, and that he allowed his inner circle to have disagreements. I think people talk to Bob Woodward because they know that Bob will talk to you or go talk behind your back to someone who knows you.
Whatever the answer is, I wish I knew it, because it seems to be a great way to get, best-selling books. But I think, you know, what the book portrays is, I think, understandable ambivalence. Who would not be ambivalent about the choice between letting Afghanistan devolve into chaos with implications for Pakistan and going forward with all of the problems we face with a very weak partner there?
Mm-hmm. Last word, George.
The book distracted attention from the fact that a corrupt government elected by a corrupt election presided over another corrupt election in Afghanistan.
This weekend was pretty dire indeed. And this conversation will continue in the green room. And we just also wanted to give you a word about a special program next week. The plans to build that Islamic center near Ground Zero has unleashed an international debate, raising questions about America's uneasy relationship with Islam. So next Sunday, we're going to hear from all sides in this debate. It's going to be called Holy War, Should We Be Afraid of Islam? You can submit questions too on my Facebook page or at our website, abcnews.com/townhall. And this coming Friday, Diane Sawyer anchors a special edition of 2020, reporting on Islam and taking all the questions and answers. Finally this morning, our picture this week. It's a moment in history.
I am not satisfied as an American with the progress that we are making. This is a great country, but I think it could be a greater country. And this is a powerful country, but I think it could be a more powerful country.
And that was 50 years ago today, when more than 80 million Americans watched John F. Kennedy and Richard Nixon hold the first ever televised presidential debate. Viewers saw a calm and cool, relatively unknown candidate on the same stage as the vice president, who refused to wear makeup and looked uncomfortable. Kennedy, of course, won the election, and after that campaign, Nixon never debated again. But the format spread around the world, and TV face-offs have become common rituals in elections all over the globe, as well as here in the United States. That's our program. Thank you for watching, and we hope to see you next week with our special Town Hall.